Escobedo v. Bender.
May it please the Court, Mr. Sutherland. My clients are appealing the denial of qualified immunity for their actions in using tear gas and flashbang devices in an effort to extricate Rudy Escobedo, an individual who was suicidal, high on cocaine, delusional, and armed with a handgun, from his seventh-floor apartment in downtown Fort Wayne, following a four-hour attempt at negotiating his extrication from that apartment. This court in Wernsing versus Thompson has framed the issue nicely. In Wernsing versus Thompson, this court held the issue about qualified immunity is not whether the actions of my clients were expressly authorized by existing case law in July of 2005 when this incident occurred, but rather whether their conduct was expressly forbidden by existing case law at the time.
Can you distinguish then the existing case law from some of our cases from this circuit, as well as maybe the estate of Smith versus Marasco from the Third Circuit, where you had very similar facts with the mentally ill individual who was armed in his house with no hostages?
Yes.
From 2003?
Yes, I believe that that case and the others from this circuit are distinguishable, and it's important as a prelude to looking at each of those cases to consider the Supreme Court has held that the cases, in order to be considered similar, have to be factually similar in all regards. If they're not factually similar in all regards, then the violation has to be one that's an obvious constitutional violation. With regard to the Smith versus Marasco case, in that particular incident, there was no indication that a gun was ever even seen with Mr. Smith, inside his home. There was a suspicion that he might have a gun, but none was ever seen. In that case, they had no negotiations, no contact with him at all. They tried, but they never were able to establish any contact, so they knew nothing about his condition inside the home, whether he was suicidal or posed a threat to anyone. In addition, in that case, they had prior experience with him and knew about his considerable health conditions and the potential that any kind of an assault on his home could result in his death.
Okay, factually identical is not necessary, though. Factually similar is. And if you look at that case, again, that's a Third Circuit case. That's not
Yes.
a Seventh Circuit case. But if you look at that case, wouldn't the threat even be less here in that you have someone who you know is in the house alone? He's mentally ill, and he does have a weapon, but he's the only danger he is would be to himself, I assume, at that moment.
I don't believe that's the only danger, but certainly that was a danger, and I think that that is another distinguishing factor. We knew in this case from the negotiations that were ongoing with Mr. Escobedo that he was suicidal. He was a danger to himself. He had a gun, had the ability to commit suicide, and stated it on a number of occasions, that was his intention to do that. In the other Smith versus Marasco case, there was no indication that the gentleman was suicidal, homicidal, or a threat to anyone at the time.
Was he on drugs in Marasco?
There was no indication one way or the other in the
Marasco
case.
Because the defendant here was, right? He was on cocaine and had the mental illness.
Yes, he was on cocaine. He admitted he had been taking cocaine all night. Later toxicology studies did establish and confirm that was so. And he also made a number of comments at the time about seeing police officers outside his seventh floor window or them being inside the apartment when they were not, and other statements which indicated to the negotiator that he was delusional at the time as well. So the facts are distinguishable from that Marasco case and from all of the other cases upon which the district court attempts to rely. And in fact, Judge Springman conceded in her decision that this was a novel case and no very similar cases could be found. The cases that were relied upon in addition to the Marasco case were cases involving the use of tear gas against handcuffed suspects or the use of tear gas against prisoners in their cell, presenting no danger to anyone else in a punitive fashion, the use of tear gas against protesters who were peacefully protesting.
There's a number of cases cited, though, from this circuit regarding the use of the flashbang devices, the Folks case and the Morris case and the Jones case, all of which this court talked about when it is reasonable to use such a device. And on more than one occasion, in dicta, has talked about the requirement not to injure others and to carry a fire extinguisher, for example, so as not to cause a fire. Can you distinguish those cases?
Well, first of all, it is important to mention that those cases, the discussion about the use of tear gas or flashbang was in dicta. It was not the holding of the case, and the courts did not find in those cases that it was unconstitutional to use flashbangs under those particular circumstances. So the law could not be clearly established by those cases to give my clients notice that what they were doing violated the Constitution. Clearly, the court expressed concerns about the circumstances that flashbang devices would be used and the potential for injury to either the occupants or bystanders. So that's not the, those aren't the kind of decisions that can establish the precedent that's required to meet this heavy burden that remains with the plaintiff in this case to establish that my clients are not entitled to qualified immunity.
The actions here took place over a considerable period of time. I don't remember how many hours it was, but
approximately 4 hours.
And it seems to be that they're segregated. There was a particular action about the negotiations with them, and then the decision about the tear gas, and then entering the apartment, and then the flashbangs, and then the confrontation with the individual himself. I mean, how do we look at this?
The court needs to look at it precisely as it unfolded in this chronological order, step-by-step process, and analyze and evaluate at each stage, at each step, whether the law was clearly established that what my clients did next was unconstitutional. Because unless the law was clearly established, or it was so obvious that every reasonable police officer would know that they're not permitted to do what they did, then they're entitled to qualified immunity for any mistakes they may have made in those judgments. In this case, they did spend almost 4 hours in negotiating with Mr. Escobedo to extricate him from the apartment with a trained negotiator for 4 hours. That negotiator concluded and passed on to the supervisors that the negotiations had broken down, there was no progress being made, no reason to believe he was going to come out of the apartment voluntarily. That was passed on to the commanders of the SWAT team and the scene commander, who at that point determined that in light of that, those developments and the exhaustion of those negotiations, that the next step to try and extricate him from the apartment was to use tear gas. They had a history of using tear gas in similar circumstances successfully in forcing the individual out of the home or apartment without there being any need for a SWAT team to go in, without there being any violence used in getting the person the medical care they needed.
What was the level of risk at the moment around the three-hour mark where they just determined he wasn't going to come out? So he wasn't going to come out with his weapon to hurt someone else. So what's the level of risk at that point?
The risk at that point when the negotiations have reached a what the negotiator determined to be a breakdown or a failure in negotiations increased the level or likelihood that Mr. Escobedo would commit suicide.
Okay.
So at that point, the risk is higher than it was when they first started the negotiations that he would commit suicide. And so in order to extricate from the apartment and try and eliminate that risk, without negotiations making any progress, the use of tear gas was the next step in the process to try and force him out and end the situation and get him the treatment he needed.
Did they make a mistake on the amount of tear gas, or was that just a judgment that was not a correct one at the time?
No, neither one, I believe.
Okay.
The amount of the tear gas that was determined by the commander of the SWAT team, Officer Zelt, was based upon his training and experience in using tear gas with respect to the size of the location. And I know the term he used is incapacitating, and it may not be entirely clear from the record what that means, but it's a term of art with respect to the use of tear gas in studies that have been done by the military about what the level of discomfort caused by tear gas will cause someone to leave a structure or remove themselves from where the location of the tear gas is. So this was not an amount of tear gas that was intended to be a lethal amount. It was simply an amount that was determined in the judgment of this trained SWAT commander that would likely force Mr. Escobedo out of his apartment. And it's important to keep in mind that it wasn't dispensed all at once. There was a first round of tear gas that was entered into the apartment, and then a waiting of 10 minutes for Mr. Escobedo to have time to come out. When that didn't work, there was a second round of tear gas that was entered into the apartment, and again, 10 minutes waiting for him to come out, and he did not. That was when the next step about going into the apartment occurred.
Was there a window in the bedroom where tear gas could come from the outside?
There was one there was a bathroom attached to the bedroom, and I don't remember specifically. I believe there was a window in the bedroom as well, and a window in the main room of the apartment. This was a one bedroom, one other kind of general room with a kitchen and a
there
living
was tear
area.
Gas in bedroom itself.
Yes, there was. They tried to dispense it into all the rooms of the home and that was another thing. I mean, they don't know where he is in the apartment at the time. He could be in the bathroom, he could be in the bedroom, he could be in the main living room area, and so they have to put this tear gas in these different places, not knowing what precautions or efforts he would make or would make in the process to defend or protect himself from the effects of the tear gas.
So the threat is considered increased each time that they fire more tear gas in, that he doesn't leave the building.
Right. The greater threat that he is going to commit suicide or attempt to commit suicide at that point, he's becoming even more resistive to the efforts of the officers to extricate him when the level of force is elevated and he's still resisting that. And so then when the SWAT team goes in at that point, they know that he's got a gun and won't put it down and has threatened to shoot himself. They know he's high on cocaine. They know he's delusional, and they know in the face of everything, 4 hours of negotiations, plus the use of this tear gas, that he won't come out. At that point, they know that they're at risk themselves of being shot by Mr. Escobedo when they go into the apartment.
The problem I have here is that it's easy to look at this in hindsight, where you see that Evitino is basically driven out by the tear gas. They switch phones so that Escobedo can't even call the same number. Nobody's answering it because they're using a different phone. So in hindsight, there's a real breakdown here. What I have a hard time with is the foresight of why is it worth risking lives of police officers to keep a guy from committing suicide?
Well, I guess the opposite question or the contrary question is what should the officers do when they're called to a scene where someone wants to commit suicide? Should they abandon that person and let them commit suicide and make no effort to get them out?
See, in hindsight, you just leave Evitino up there, listen to the guy say yes, no, yes, no. But this is the perplexing thing with all this tear gas and with all these officers and then this entry and with the flashbang and the tear gas, weapons drawn. This seems like such an overkill if there ever one really happened. And that's the hard thing for me to understand is the magnitude of this effort to keep a guy from committing suicide. Rather than spending more time, more patience with Evitino and him going back and forth.
Certainly, given the outcome of the case, it's easy to second guess the decisions.
I'm not trying to do that.
It's important that recognize there is no case law out there that provides any parameters to these officers about the thing you suggest is how long should they wait? Should they have waited another hour, another 4 hours, another 12 hours, 24 hours?
Was there a change in
hours?
Shift?
There was not. These were teams, SWAT teams, and negotiating teams that were called out for the specific purpose of responding to this particular incident. So none of them were on duty at the time. They were all, when this first started on 4 o'clock in the morning, they were all paged and came out as part of these teams. They all have other duties in addition to working as a SWAT team member or crisis intervention team.
Do they have psychologists or psychiatrists as a part of these teams?
No, not specifically, but they do have training with respect to those issues. That's why their negotiators are specifically trained in dealing with suicidal individuals. I'd like to reserve, if I could, the balance of my time.
Mr. Sutherland?
If it pleases the court, Mr. Keene, I'd like to address some of the questions that were raised by this panel because Mr. Keene has selectively ignored most of the critical facts that would distinguish this case. Their briefs suggest this is a unique case. Their training is to the would suggest to the contrary. There are over 40,000 suicides in the United States. The Veterans Administration says that they count in their VA hospitals 1,000 suicide attempts a month. So it is perhaps more dangerous to call the SWAT team from Fort Wayne on a 911 call for an emergency assistance, medical health assistance, than it may have been on the battlefield. This is outrageous conduct. It shocks the conscience. Here's the facts that they've ignored in their opening statement and they've ignored in their briefs. Mr. Escobedo had a phone. He was on the phone with the dispatcher for 21 minutes, repeatedly saying he wanted to commit suicide, he wanted help. He gave them the name of his counselor. He gave them the name of his sister. They contacted the counselor and said, "Don't bother coming." He said, "I'm afraid of the police. Please don't send the police." They had all that information. This is in hindsight. This is information they had in hand.
Well, you mentioned they contacted the counselor. They actually got a hold of him and told him you're not needed?
They left a message. When he called at 8 o'clock, they said, "We've got it under control. Don't bother coming." That's what they told him, and that's in the record. We have his deposition. He said, "I have no information that he would ever hurt anybody." Whether that was shared with the command central, I can't say. Let me go back to another misstatement.
May I ask you the question of what were they supposed to do? Wait there all day outside of the house? Because that's precisely under the qualified immunity. We're not supposed to really be second-guessing Monday morning quarterbacking what they did as far as trying to get him out of the house.
They didn't refer to their expert once. Our expert said that 3 hours is just the threshold of beginning to gain the confidence of somebody who is barricaded. This is not a hostage situation. Nobody's at risk. The public's not at risk. He's made no threatening gestures to the police. And in fact, the inconsistencies are enormous. They try to contact the people on the floor in anticipation of using the tear gas, but they don't get everybody. The implication is if you don't come out on the one knock, you may get shot up when we hit the place.
So that is what they were supposed to do, is to just simply wait more time and enter.
Well, there may be some outside point, but here are the things that they know for fact. People get hungry. People get thirsty. They're going to come down on their cocaine. People who are suicidal, if you've been in counseling, if you've been dealing with people who are suicidal, there's a progression of up and down, and finally they flatten out when the trust is gained. So there isn't any outside limit. Our expert and all the literature suggest that if you just have the patients and there's no public safety issue involved here, the patients will receive positive results every time.
What cases are you relying on to establish that these officers must have known there was a clearly established law prohibiting them from doing certain things? And I think Judge Kaney's remark and question is one that we need to address with you as well, which is at what point? Is it at the point that the tear gas went in, that it was clearly established? Is it at the point of the entry itself when we have someone who's mentally ill? Is it at the point where the flash bang device is thrown?
Judge Springman applied Graham versus Connor, I think, as a sort of the starting point, and that is, this is a case about excessive force, whether the use of force was appropriate. And the leading cases suggest that if you look at the degree of the crime involved, you look at the public safety risk, and you look to see whether or not the person is likely to flee. When the police showed up, they had no intention of arresting him. They were trying to take him into custody and take him to a hospital for treatment. It was a 911 call for help, not for police. The second thing, there was no public safety risk at all. It was fabricated. And you talk about hindsight. This was invented. Traffic, hospital, concern about the police. None of that is supported in the record. Invented. So if you apply the summary judgment standard that is giving us the benefit of all the facts and all the reasonable inferences from that facts, they ignore that. They ignore the very summary judgment standard that has been universally applied in all the circuits. So the case that we're talking about, the Marasco case, is as close as it can come. But the case law from Saussier or even Hope versus Pelser says if it shocks the conscience, if it's so outrageous that you don't necessarily need to find a case on all fours, you should look to the criteria established under Graham versus Connor, that is it appropriate? Here's what we have. We have somebody who's there who's desperate. And contrary to what Mr. Keene said, there was progress. Ebatino violated about 4 or 5 of his major cardinal policies. He went to the scene outside the door instead of staying at Command Central. He used a cell phone, which could not be heard by everybody involved. So they had to relay the information. That should have informed them that they were not going to get accurate, reliable, consistent, complete picture. They just couldn't do it. The second thing is they told him to lie about why he was leaving. So he does that. We knew from the, and here's the other thing that I want to emphasize. We knew after the fact that he was trying to call. So contrary to him not cooperating, he has called 4 times and nobody answers. And I think your question was, that's in hindsight. They had to know that he was not in communication. The communicator left. So they know they had cut off the communications. He goes down to Command Central. He's there. He's not on a phone. The command people have to know that there's no communication. And everyone talked as if they assumed there was communication. That is a lie. That is a fabrication. They had to know there was no communications. We discovered this because when we went to the phone, it looked as if it had been in a fire. It looked destroyed. So we didn't even try to turn it on. And well, we did try to turn it on. It wouldn't turn on. One of my clever law clerks suggested, well, did you charge it up? Good question. So we got charger, drove back up there, and plugged it in. The light comes on. It took a weekend to charge it. What we discovered through defense counsel's reporting to us that there were 4 calls attempted. Now, you call that hindsight. Here's what I suggest, Judge Mannion. There were 2 calls made after the person died on that phone. So that meant they had to open up the phone, and most phones have a registry of calls made, attempts, and so forth. That information was found when they opened it up. That meant that they opened it up after they took custody of it. It wasn't just hindsight. They knew, and when they published their version of the facts to the media, they were lying.
What are you saying? They tried to destroy the phone after they recovered it?
No. Yeah. The phone, there was a flashbang that was thrown into the bedroom area.
The phone he was using.
The phone he was using was used after the police took custody of it. And we believe that they had to know that fact because they had custody of it. There were 2 phone calls made as demonstrated on the phone records.
Well, who does that imply made the phone calls?
It implies somebody who had custody of the phone. The police were had custody of it. The forensic team took possession of it, put it in a bag, and they had it. There was no one else to have used that phone except the police.
But then after that, somebody finds it, says it's all destroyed, and then somebody had plugged it in and recharged it. Is that what the phone we're talking about?
It's the same phone. No, it looked destroyed. That's the reason we didn't think it worked, and that's the reason we didn't try to charge it up right away. But here's what I'm trying to explain. The reason it looked destroyed is because the flashbang was tossed into the bedroom, contrary to their training. You're supposed to roll it in so you don't injure somebody. There's a mark on the closet where Mr. Escobedo had positioned himself. He was sitting on the floor with his legs outstretched. The mark on the wall, this flash, is about 2 feet from his head. That flashbang probably so debilitated him, not just sort of blinded him and made him deaf, but it probably injured him according to the capability and the potential of that bomb, as it's described in Seventh Circuit case law, going off within 2 feet of his head. Now, when the police come in, going to your question, they're in a combat mode. The officers thought they were going to be shot. Why didn't they just stop and say, I don't hear anything, would you come out, or we're going to have to come in? They didn't do any of that. They just went in. There isn't a person in this room, if you heard all the facts, that would have predicted a different outcome. A dark room, gas masks, so much tear gas that nobody can even imagine it. And in fact, the one shooter, Martin, bumps his head, just cracks it, and he can't even stand it, and he has to exit it. So you've got a person in here who, instead of being helped, is being attacked. Almost a military operation. They had a command personnel carrier that was an armored personnel carrier. They had machine guns. They had snipers. They had 48 people show up. And even though the tactical team and the response team were there as a special unit, there's no evidence that all these other people around the outside left. They carried over another shift. Mr. Escobedo was on the phone for 21 minutes to the dispatcher, explaining his dilemma, wanting, seeking help, praying for help. We have the tapes, and we have his tone. He is then talking to a Mr. Taylor who shows up, who is not trained as a CIT person, crisis intervention, but he's very good, and he gains the confidence of them. He passes the phone off to Epitino. Epitino begins to negotiate. And contrary to the statements made by defense counsel, there was incredible progress. He said, I really like you. There was evidence that he removed the furniture from the front door, a positive sign. He goes up and down, like a lot of us. We can't make up our mind when we're making a critical decision. There was, in fact, progress. What is really inexcusable is that the purpose for calling out the crisis intervention team to help him was overshadowed and overridden by the tactical team that arbitrarily picked a time. He said 3 or 4 hours. They made the decision. They wanted to go in with tear gas, according to Mr. Epitino, at 6:45. That's when he first learned about it. That's what he said in his deposition, 6:45. So he gets there after 5 o'clock. He hasn't even talked to him for an hour and 15 minutes, and they want to start tossing in tear gas. This was so arbitrary that nobody can believe that there was anything but a mindset to take this place as if it were a military objective. That's what shocks the conscience.
I'd like to go back to your reliance on Marasco. Are you relying then on any of the Seventh Circuit cases for clearly established law in the area of flashbang devices, or are you simply relying on the theory that it shocks the conscience and so it would be obvious to any officer?
Both. And if I point out the Seventh Circuit cases and the other circuits, which primarily deal with tear gas in a criminal setting, are really applying the Eighth Amendment, which is a higher standard. And even in those situations where they say there's no justification for using tear gas or flashbangs, where there is no evidence of a public safety or threat to the custodial officers or the police officers, you cannot use that. It is, in fact, a weapon. The SAGE weapon, at that close of range, was regarded as a lethal weapon. The person was, the shooter, Mr. Martin, was 4 to 6 feet. That meant his muzzle could have been within 2 feet. The SAGE shooter said he was 10 to 12 feet back. And then, and we say in our brief, his argument that they hit the legs is a creation. It's a fabrication. There is suggestion that, in fact, the SAGE shooter shot afterwards to cover up his purposeful role, which is to shoot first. There is no marks on the upper body. There's a mark on the leg, and the SAGE was so close that it broke his leg. I mean, these people were out of control. They were in a combat mode when they went in there. They said, I thought I was going to get shot. Why would you go into a place when there's no threat to you if you thought you were going to get shot? You'd wait. I do a lot of police work. There is a concept called indexing cover. You stay behind an object so you cannot get shot. You negotiate. You continue to talk. And as long as you're protected with a barrier, there's no threat to you.
Let me go back again to the clearly established. So it's your position then that it was clearly established that they should not have used tear gas at all?
Correct.
And that they should not have entered the house at all?
In this situation, that is correct.
And that because there was no threat, and that they should not have used the flashbang devices?
That is correct.
And you're relying both on Marasco from the Third Circuit and on the dicta from Folks and Morris, is that correct?
Yes. All of that. And I might point out that the recent Supreme Court decision just decided yesterday, which we referred to in the Pearson case? The Pearson case, yes. Pearson versus Callahan. I've read it. I'm not sure I fully understand it just yet, but it does not seem to change the test. And, in fact, it gives the courts more flexibility in looking at whether or not a police officer would be reasonably informed about the parameters of his authority to use deadly force. So while there is no absolute requirement to follow associate, it does suggest that the courts can look at these cases a little more broadly. That's the way I read it.
It simply eliminated the rigid two-tier process, which says first look for the constitutional violation before you move to the clearly established. It gave courts, both district and appellate, the ability to do
what we're doing, I think. Yeah, and I think that, you know, as I understand the brief and the position of the defendants, they've conceded that there is a constitutional violation. The question is whether or not they were clearly informed about the parameters of using the tear gas and the flashbangs. Now, I might point out, and I don't know whether the court wants me to address this, there are two things still pending. One is a motion to strike the briefs for failure to comply with the rules and motion for sanctions. And the ruling that we received notice from this court is that this would be assigned to the merits panel. So if there's any questions about that.
Well, your time is up, but I'll give you a couple minutes to address the sanctions.
Okay. The second thing, of course, is that we had requested that this be reviewed en banc. It was distributed according to the entries on November 14th. We've not heard anything about that yet. So those are two things that are still up in the air. I'll just bring that to your attention. The appellants in their brief misused or by accident or inadvertence the reference to the record. They just had it all wrong. So when we were reading the brief, we couldn't get it right. We knew what they were talking about, but their citations to the record were absolutely atrociously wrong. We brought it to their attention in our response, and we pointed out that they again confused Martin with Brown in the shooting. We did so politely. They ignored it. They filed their reply brief again, not correcting the record. So that went on, and we weren't sure what was going to happen. So then, just in the last few weeks, they file a motion for leave to use an amended brief. That has not been ruled upon yet. We challenged it and asked it to be stricken. Why should we go through all the trouble as the opposing party to now again review their briefs and review their citations to see if they're correct? And, of course, they then reply to our motion for sanctions apologizing profusely, saying they should have paid more attention. Well, we gave them a chance before they got it wrong. We gave them plenty of time for them to correct it, and they make the correction at the very last minute. So we believe that that sort of indifference to the procedures and indifference to this court's time and this court's resources warrants sanctions, and that the brief should be stricken and that attorney fees should be awarded to our side for the extra time in addressing these amended brief issues and clarifying whether or not the record was correct. We would like this court to affirm Judge Springman's decision and remand for further instructions with regard to sanctions and perhaps take up, hopefully, our motion to reconsider en banc. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Much time. You have 1 minute rebuttal, and then I'll give you some time to respond to the sanctions issue.
Thank you very much. You asked repeatedly what cases the appellee was relying upon to show the law was clearly established. They could cite none other than this Marasco case. And that's what's important in determining whether qualified immunity should be accorded and afforded my clients in this case. Justice Stevens, in the Hope case, indicated that the police officers have to have fair warning and notice that what they're doing violates the Constitution. In fact, he equates that fair notice and warning to what it would be required in order to criminally prosecute those police officers for willfully violating the civil rights of an individual. That can't be done based upon dicta in criminal cases, like have been presented in this court, or with one decision in the Third Circuit where the facts clearly are distinguishable from here. And it's important that the courts all over this country have held it proper in many circumstances to use tear gas and to use flashbangs. There's only been a very narrow, limited number of cases where courts have held it was unreasonable to do so.
But we have held so in United States versus Jones in 2000 that police cannot automatically throw bombs into drug dealers' houses, even if the bomb goes by the euphemism flashbang device, particularly where the drug dealer is not an unusually dangerous individual. So again, looking to the threat at the moment in time that the police are responding to.
It's important, though, to recognize the distinction between that case and the facts in this case. There are no cases that are cited involving suicidal individuals, not a single case. No court has ever determined that it is unlawful and unconstitutional to use flashbang devices or to use tear gas or to go in at any particular time or to negotiate further. What you've heard from the appellee is all Monday morning quarterback, all second-guessing. There was no clearly established law. Perhaps the judgment that these officers made was not correct in hindsight. But there was nothing that put them on notice that what they did at that particular time under these specific circumstances violated the constitutional rights of Mr. Escobedo, and therefore they're entitled to qualified immunity. this case should be remanded back to the district court with instructions to enter judgment with respect to the remaining claims against my officers. With respect to the issue about the motion for sanctions, there was an error made in our original brief in the citation to the facts. It's not an excusable error, but by way of explanation, when the summary judgment motion that we filed with all of the attachments was printed out on the federal system on our computer, it turned out that we had every document off by one document because the motion for summary judgment was not labeled as 37-1 as it is in the court's record. So all of our citations were off by one document originally. We didn't catch that error. Mr. Sutherland's right that he pointed it out to us. We should have caught it and corrected it in the reply brief. We didn't do so. But there's been no prejudice to the appellee in this case. All the facts and all the documents and all the information are precisely the same as existed in the district court. They haven't suggested they didn't know where this evidence came from or they couldn't find it or anything like that. There was no harm to them whatsoever by this inadvertent, improper reference to the record. So we'd ask that the motion for sanctions be denied.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we move to the